Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. As President-elect Joe Biden forms his administration, his incoming National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, has been discussing how the new team will manage America's increasingly fraught relationship with China, making clear that the United States will be principled and tough, but also find ways to work with Beijing. Biden has discussed convening global democracies to bring them together to deal with global challenges, whether climate change or addressing an increasingly confrontational China. But rather than wait to consult with the incoming administration seeking to reverse Trump's policies and forge closer ties with longtime allies, the European Union raced to complete a trade deal with China, driven by a German desire to protect the sale of cars and industrial products that strategists have said deals a blow to the Biden team's efforts to exert pressure on China. Meanwhile, Chinese Premier Xi Jinping has instituted a new measure that further increases his ability to deploy force to marshal industrial resources for military needs. Joining us today are Dr. Patrick Cronin, the Asia-Pacific Security Chair at the Hudson Institute Think Tank, and Randy Shriver, who until late 2019 was the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Indo-Pacific Security Affairs in the Trump administration, who is now with the Pacific Solutions Consultancy and also the chairman of the Project 2049 Institute to formalize relations with the United States and, or I should say, between the United States and Taiwan. Gentlemen, Happy New Year and welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you, Vago.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year indeed. And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Randy, I want to get your sense on this, right? The incoming administration has said that it appreciates that 2021 isn't 2014, 2016, or 2009. That it is going to take a far tougher line with Beijing, maintaining that that tougher line is necessary, especially given how aggressive China has been, not just regionally, but internationally, whether it's diplomatic, whether it's in information, whether it's in the military space or the economic space. But China is also a very, very adaptive and strategic adversary. You know, it recognized that President Trump's team was hawkish, but that the president actually was far less hawkish and might even insulate in some cases, as you saw in the ZTE case, the Chinese from pressure, all the while sort of alienating European nations. And in fact, that may have led to this trade deal where Europeans felt like, hey, look, we're going to assert our sovereignty and we're interested in doing this. And, you know, we're going to move on and not wait for the Biden team, even though the Biden team suggested, hey, guys, slow down on striking this deal. Does this trade deal ultimately hamstring the Biden administration from applying that sort of global pressure on Beijing?
Vago, my short answer is it depends. I mean, certainly it's theoretically possible to enhance trade while applying pressure and trying to achieve other objectives. In fact, we tried our own phase one trade deal in the Trump administration while applying pressure in other areas. It remains to be seen then what the Europeans have sort of gained is more market access, loosening the rules on joint ventures, et cetera, in exchange for some Chinese commitments, which I'm pretty confident they will fall short on. And so if they're not going to give up forced labor in Xinjiang, 6 months into this deal, 1 year into this deal, do the Europeans become more hardline and join us in more pressuring tactics related to human rights and potentially other issues? And where does the Biden administration move in the meantime? They're interested in cooperation in some areas themselves. So again, short answer is it depends. And I'm not so pessimistic that this will get us off to such a rough start that we won't be able to have a coherent China policy or cooperation with the EU. But it does appear we're vectoring in slightly different directions right now.
And I think that Ursula von der Leyen and the European Union has come under criticism for exactly that, right, Randy? That the Uyghur issue remains outstanding. Democracy in Hong Kong was crushed. You have all the Wolf Warrior stuff and the bad equipment that the Chinese either sold or gave away. And look what's happening, for example, in Australia, right? And then the track record of the Chinese for not living up to any of their agreements. So fundamentally, there's a lot of consternation that's being directed at the EU for having struck this deal in the first place.
Yeah, and I think appropriately so. If you read the language of the deal in these areas, many of which you just talked about, I mean, a commitment to move toward labor standards or to try to prevent forced labor from being involved in production when they deny that it's going on now. So it's pretty weak. And again, as implementation of the deal goes forward, we'll see if the Europeans are going to turn a blind eye and just try to reap the benefits of this trade deal while giving the Chinese a pass on their commitments, or if they'll actually start to ask the Chinese to live up to their word.
Patrick, what's your sense on what this deal does and the maneuvering room that the new administration is going to have on the issue?
Well, I would have preferred if the Europeans had waited a few more weeks for the Biden administration to come into power so that they could sit down and coordinate a strategy. Because the prosperity over the long term for both Europe and the United States and others is going to depend on being able to put forward a common rule set and to stand up to Chinese economic chicanery and mercantilism and national champions and the party state rules. And those are the things that are not just simply economic. This is where the economic competition with China overlaps with the political, overlaps with the technological, and even overlaps with the military arenas of competition. So the Chinese, for instance, are pressuring Australia right now with political demands, most notably the 14 informal demands that came out of the Chinese embassy in Canberra recently, all because the Australians started an inquiry into the origins of the COVID-19 virus. And while most of it is economic pressure and sanctions and trade threats, it's very much saying to Australia, as to any other country, if you want to do business with the Chinese market, you're going to have to play by our rules. The Europeans understand that, but they've opted to put their short-term interests, their markets, and their economies in front of their national security at the moment. And hopefully they're going to find some close coordination with the Biden administration so that we can, over time, over the months and years ahead, forge a stronger set of levers to keep the Chinese honest, essentially, when they want to play by only their rules, not international rules.
What's the mindset, Randy, and let me start with you and Patrick, get your sense, the new administration has to take in going and building its China strategy out? There is a concern that some have that the administration will be more interested, for example, on making an overture, for example, on climate. You know, as a friend of mine put it, if the first Biden person who arrives in Beijing is John Kerry on his jet to resuscitate a climate deal, then you're setting the tone for something that might be a little bit weaker than you would, for example, in tying it to something more serious and perhaps a little bit of toughness, right? Because not everything the Trump administration did was bad. Randy, you were responsible for a lot of very good things. Matt Pottinger has been associated with doing some very tough and appropriate things. You know, the problem is that authoritarian states had a tendency of paying attention to what the president was saying as opposed to how hawkish some of his aides were. At the end of the day, Randy, how does the administration need to build this? What are some things to consider, an approach to consider that gets you to that tough and principled place and then brings the whole international community on our side to try to block the Chinese from doing the destructive things that they've been doing?
Well, I can give advice. I don't know that that it would be very persuasive to Biden colleagues, but I've given them my view during talks with the transition team, and will continue to say things publicly like on this program. But it seems to me it doesn't start with China. It starts with allies, and it starts with friends and partners. And the Biden transition team has said the right things about trying to reinvest in those relationships. I think, frankly, they'll find out that some of those relationships are in better shape than their campaign rhetoric might have suggested. But nonetheless, that's the place to start, is with the friends and allies, and shore up where you need to shore up. We've got some issues over burden sharing with Korea and Japan. We've got other issues with Korea. Australia is asking questions about how we can be a good partner to them as they're facing economic coercion and the like. Once you survey that and take the steps you need to take to put that on a better trajectory, then you can think about the more direct engagement of China and what can be improved there. And I think what I would say is keep in place many of the measures that were taken to put us on a better posture for competition. But certainly be open to cooperation where our interests align. I wouldn't lead with that, and I wouldn't give the Chinese the impression that we're going to be the ardent suitor and therefore create leverage for them, which is an old playbook that we've seen many times. If they get the sense we're so desperate for cooperation, they'll be the ones that start to put out asks and obstacles in order to get to that point of cooperation. So I certainly have no problem with talking to the Chinese about climate change. But if they understand that it's a priority above all else and we're willing to make sacrifices in order to get their pledges of cooperation, not even genuine cooperation, but pledges of it, then I think we're starting down a difficult track, and we've seen the movie before.
Patrick?
Well, I agree with Randy. Climate change is real and serious, but that doesn't mean China wants to cooperate on our terms. And it can't be the centerpiece or the totality of our approach toward China, which covers so many arenas and so many issues. It's incumbent on the United States under the Biden administration to carry forth the good elements of the Trump administration. We're now awake to the China challenge, but as it seeks to cooperate, it shouldn't just give in to the necessity of making quick deals that sell short our long-term interests. So it's important not only to maintain deterrence on places like the Cross Strait or in South China Sea or on the border with India or on the Korean Peninsula, but it's also important to put in place the cooperative mechanisms to try to avoid crisis escalation, something that Joe Nye has talked about recently. The problem with that, as Randy knows so well, is you've got to have a willing partner on the other side with the Chinese, and same thing with the climate change deal. China will envelop the Biden administration in endless meetings that seem to be cooperative, that seem to build cooperative frameworks, but don't necessarily lead to any meaningful change or really break on China's more malign activities. And that's a problem. That's why the Biden administration has to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time here. It's got to take the hard line with China when it comes to malign behavior, and it has to take the soft line and soft power when it comes to areas that are very specific, we can cooperate with China.
Randy, you've sat in those meetings. Patrick, I should say, you've done that as well. But Randy, more recently, you've sat through these meetings on a military and on a governmental level, right? What are the ways the Chinese basically run the clock down, right? I mean, have you, and what are the keys from your standpoint to actually making progress in these conversations, as opposed to talking to talk, or for us to do things that are in their interest and maybe not in ours, because we sometimes fail to understand what they will respond to, right?
Well, I think that's exactly right. I think we've traditionally made a few types of the same kinds of mistakes, which one, we tend to want to tell them what's in their interest rather than truly listen to them and understand what's in their interests. I've seen this repeatedly play out on the Korean Peninsula, where we're convinced we know what their interests are better than they do, and we can't understand why they won't help us more forcefully enforce the sanctions, for example. We end up negotiating with ourselves. We're, you know, Americans are problem solvers. We want to get to win-win, not how the Chinese define it, which is they win twice, but a way that we can both benefit and improve the lie, if you will, in the golf sense. But we end up negotiating with ourselves because they often have more patience. They often see that we want to get to an answer. And so if we are able to remove one obstacle, they'll just place another one there. And third, you know, I I think they do play the long game a little better. They're able to prioritize what strategic interests are in ways that sometimes Americans who are, you know, short-term political appointees or driven by election cycles or whatever it may be, want to get to an outcome in ways that their system doesn't pressure them in the same ways. And so I think it's, you know, accounting for all that, being very steady and understanding our long-term interests and not negotiating with ourselves, bringing in partners and allies who have shared interests, shared concerns, so that those points are being reinforced by other voices. And then, you know, just understand that the areas of cooperation are probably going to be limited and be satisfied if we can have positive cooperation, even at sort of a minimal basis of preventing accidents, incidents, conflict, as Patrick was suggesting.
Patrick, I want to go to you in a moment because I know that you worked very closely, including at CNAS, with some of the folks who are going to be populating the new administration and have been in dialogue with them as well. You know, a friend of mine who served in the Reagan administration made a great point that was, I think, applicable to how the Reagan administration changed the dynamic with the Japanese in the 1980s over microelectronics, that it was to bring the totality of the relationship in, right? Put whaling and sea turtles and a number of other things on the table that the Japanese didn't want to discuss. And then because you put the totality of the relationship on the table, you're now pressuring things, the Japanese, on things that they were vulnerable to pressure under in order to drive a deal forward. From your standpoint, what are the keys to making progress with the Chinese as opposed to talking ourselves into a deal that is in their interest?
I think the first key is to make sure that we are clear about what we're seeking from the Chinese that really matters for U.S. interests. So if the Chinese want economic market access to the sort of like-minded countries and especially to the U.S. market, then it's going to have to live up to our standards and to our transparency and be accountable. And we can't sort of trade that off for some political benefit for political leaders. So we're going to have to stick to whatever deals we strike and make sure that they really matter. So as we think about, this goes back to the EU investment deal between Europe and China, who is going to enforce the rules and who's going to even monitor the enforcement of the rules? And if we're not enforcing the rules with China, they will ignore them. They will flout them. They will circumvent them. So it's very important that whatever deal we make, we ensure that we have a plan to implement it. Just as we, on the COVID-19 plan, we had a great plan for developing rapid vaccines, but we had a very poor plan, apparently, for doling out the vaccinations. We didn't invest enough in that. We have with China to invest in not just the negotiations of what the issues are, whether it's nuclear issues or whether it's economic or technological issues, but we're going to have to make sure that we have the ability to follow through and to carry this out. I mean, just go back to the South China Sea and the maritime dimensions of this policy in Asia, and you think about these new UUVs that are gliding around the choke points of the South China Sea. Chinese don't talk about these, but the Indonesians just caught another one, fishermen did. And they're not only mapping the ocean floor for economic benefit, but they're also submarine hunting. And they're basically paving the way for both economic and military benefits in the long term. The Chinese are not going to talk about that. They don't want to. They think that doesn't exist as long as they don't talk about it. So we're going to have to be the ones who not only negotiate what's of importance to the United States and the international community, but we're also going to have to tell the truth about what the Chinese are up to while we're doing this. And that's going to be a tough set of negotiations. Fortunately, I think some of the people going into the Biden administration have some very sharp elbows and are able to call things out. And I'm thinking about Torian Nuland and Wendy Sherman, for instance, and even Colin Kahl going into DOD. All of these people have real depth on international security issues and are willing to speak up about what China might be doing.
Let me quickly get your guys' sense on the national security or the national defense law change in China that gives Xi Jinping greater authority to mobilize civilian resources and actually gives the Central Military Commission a lot more power than the nation's cabinet over some policymaking decisions, right? Takes it away from the State Council. What does this mean? Because, Randy, because I sense that for the Chinese never do anything without a really clear purpose. And normally, sometimes a lot years earlier than they may need to exercise that authority. Why now? What does this mean?
I think that's right. I can't say for certain if this is done with the intention of positioning themselves for a known policy shift or plan, a plan of action, or whether it's just playing out Xi's normal instinct, which is always to consolidate power further and give himself more right. direct authority. I suspect it's the latter. It's sort of reflexive on his part to want more direct control. And although the State Council acts somewhat like a cabinet, it wasn't exactly that, but it did allow the potential for more voices to be in play during a national security decision. And so that sort of eliminates it. And if you look at the composition of the Central Military Commission right now, Xi is so firmly in control. Everyone else, including the vice chairs, are uniform military members who are quite accustomed to taking orders and direction. It's a consolidation. It's just not clear if it's a consolidation done with a specific policy move in mind, or if it's just to be positioned for more direct authority for any future contingency.
Patrick, your sense on what it all means?
Well, what it all means is that although it is reflexive and it's defensive, and China is basically risk averse, even under Xi Jinping, sooner or later, we're going to be very surprised when the PLA comes out to fight. I just sat on a commission, one of many members, co-chaired by Randy Shriver, a great commission looking at the importance of South Asia and China's competition there. A very important report, I think. But I think the world was surprised by the bloodshed that was spilt this past year. And that was nothing. That was just a small skirmish. And maybe it wasn't intentional. Maybe it just happened. But we see Xi Jinping just calling out this past week to be even more ready. I'm sure Randy heard this many times when he was the assistant secretary, how many times Xi Jinping was calling for greater readiness to fight at in a moment's notice. And one of these days, it's going to matter. So consolidating power will matter. We just don't know when.
Let me put this question to the both of you, because the Chinese look just not at military capability. And we could argue that the United States isn't fielding the kind of capabilities we need to field to deter China. And deterrence only works if an adversary sees you have the capability, but also will. If I'm sitting in Beijing and looking at the United States, we mismanaged the pandemic, killing hundreds of thousands of Americans. We've mismanaged the rollout of the vaccine. There's political discord of a like that's extraordinary. And at the end of the day, even the Army Materiel Command that would play a critical wartime role in supplying weapons and arms and capabilities to the four corners of the earth, twice sort of made errors domestically in vaccine distribution. Does this all erode American deterrence when 200 members of Congress are contesting the legitimate election of a president on completely specious claims of fraud? I mean, ultimately, isn't this a greater indicator, if you're sitting in Beijing, these guys are not only not ready for prime time, but if they can't agree to wear masks, are they going to send their sons and daughters and husbands and partners to fight on behalf of Taiwan and the Pacific? Randy, and then Patrick.
Well, it's clearly not our best foot forward, but it would be a mistake if they assessed what was happening here domestically in a manner that suggests we're incapable of dealing with a contingency. Set aside for a moment the political will. Historically, remember, we built a tremendous war machine and were very successful with great cost, but very successful in World War II. And that was done during the midst of the Great Depression. So the United States is capable of of many things in the military domain when we put our minds to it. The other thing I would say is, our great asymmetric advantage is not our weapon systems. It's really our system of alliances and friends and partners. And those that did best with COVID-19, it's not China. It's Taiwan. It's New Zealand. It actually is the democracies
of South Korea.
And so I think there's enough interest in containing Chinese behavior and malign activities so that we would be able to muster the capabilities and the will to push back against that. So, again, not our best foot forward. And I think these are very serious challenges that we need to get our hands around. And I hope for more enlightened leadership in the days ahead on both sides of the aisle. And hopefully we can address these things. But it would be a mistake to think we were not capable of responding in the event of a contingency.
There's a big debate about how the United States should respond to Russia over its unprecedented cyber operations against the U.S. government and industry. Some see it as a legitimate espionage. Others are saying that it's tantamount to an act of war and that the Biden administration has to respond. And there does appear that the Biden administration is going to respond much more forcefully than I believe the Trump administration has responded to anything that's dealt with the word Russia. How important is the response to Moscow as a deterrent to Beijing? Randy and then Patrick.
I think it's extremely important, given particularly what we've gone through in the last 4 years, that something be done to send the message to Russia and anybody else that these are unacceptable activities.
Patrick?
It was vital to point to firm attribution that it was the Russians. And then we need to find out whether this was more than espionage, but indeed prepping the battlefield for the future.
Gentlemen, thanks very, very much for joining us. Really appreciate it and can't wait to have you guys back on again. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Vago.
Thank you, Vago.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.